with your permission, I want to talk about, we'll talk a little bit about tefillah. It comes up in the parasha. Right? Moshe Rabbeinu says to Bnei Yisrael, V'etchanan, the first pasuk, V'etchanan el Hashem ba'eta hilemo. V'etchanan, a difficult word. What makes it difficult is not the word itself, but comparing it to other words that mean something similar. In other words, if you ask the question, in what way is this word different than the word v'etpalel, for example, that's hard to answer. But if you just think of v'etchanan as a word representing tefillah, that's easy enough, okay? So Moshe Rabbeinu davened. But when I say that Moshe Rabbeinu davened, what do I mean? Like, why did he daven differently than when the Torah says v'etpalel? So Rashi says, Rashi, look at Rashi. Ein chanun b'kol makom, elo shon matnat chinam. Elo shon matnat. That the word chet nun nun, right? He says chanun, but the word, the root, chet nun nun, is somehow related to the root in Hebrew, chet nun mem. And mem and nun, you know, they get mixed up sometimes, so they're easily interchangeable. So v'et chanan is like v'et chanam. And chanam comes from the word chinam, for free. And that means avopi shiyesh lahem letzadikim litlot b'ma'aseihem atovim ein v'akshim me'edem akom ela matnat chinam. Now this I find always an amazing statement in Rashi, that when tzaddikim daven, they don't say, I'm a tzaddik, therefore grant my wish. Or, you know, I have a lot of points in my account in heaven, so grant my wish. They don't say that. Right? They say, tzaddikim litlot b'maaseihem atovim, they always ask, give me something for nothing. They never say, give me something for in exchange for the goodness that I have done. Okay, that's what he says. Lefisha amar lo, v'chanoti et asher achon, right, that this is the way God treats us. So in other words, it's like Moshe Rabbeinu is standing before God and he has no merits. He's not offering God, or he's not demanding some return on the basis of things that he did in the past. But he says, I don't have anything to offer, but I'm begging you. I'm begging God. So this is what Rashi says. That the word vet chanan is special. It's different than the word vet palel. The word vet palel is regular. Vet chanan is a word that could be used for the righteous. Because the righteous don't think that God owes them anything. But the non-righteous, they might think that that they deserve special consideration from HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Okay. Davar acher, ze echad b'asara l'shonot shenikrei tefillah k'dita b'sifrei. So Rashi quotes the Sifri that says, just that in Hebrew, there are 10 different roots that are used to mean to pray. Right? In other words, to say, this word bet chanan doesn't mean anything. It could have been bet palel. It could have been something else, right? But we should not look for meaning. It was Rashi is sort of stymied, I would say, that on this matter, Rashi is not clear. He doesn't help us to understand really why the verb vet chanan is used instead of the verb vet palel, which itself is interesting. The second half of the pasuk says, "Ba'etahi lemor, ba'etahi at that time, lemor." Okay, ba'etahi. Rashi says this remarkable thing. L'achar shekavash the eretz sichel va'og, the miti shema hutar haneder. So again, what are we talking about? We're talking about a neder. Whose neder are we talking about? Whose oath are we talking about? God, right? God's oath. God said, Moshe Rabbeinu, you and Aaron, you're not going into Eretz Yisrael. So the question, of course, is how could he have imagined, he, Moshe Rabbeinu, have imagined that you could pray for something that God has already closed the door on? I mean, just like, what is the process in which Moshe Rabbeinu thought of that? So Rashi comes up with this interesting idea that since they conquered the land of Sichon Va'og, remember, Sichon Va'og were on the eastern side of the Jordan River, right? The eastern side of the Jordan River. They conquered the land of Sichon and Og. And then Moshe Rabbeinu gave that land away to Reuven, who else? And God, and Chatzi Shevet, Menashe. So that means what has already happened? There's already been Nachla in Eretz Yisrael. That's already happened. And where is Moshe Rabbeinu? He's there. He's there in Eretz Yisrael, which has already been given out to Reuven, God, Chatzi Shevet, Menashe. So he came to the conclusion. Moshe Rabbeinu came to conclusion, which is a problem that we have. We come to conclusions about things, which is why, you know, Adam and Chava made a mistake and ate from the Eitz HaDaat, because they thought incorrectly about things. So that, to a certain extent, the wild card in creation, even though the Kabbalah has other ideas, but the wild card in creation is our ability to reason. Because our ability to reason doesn't always bring me to the correct conclusion. But often brings me to an incorrect conclusion, as any scientist, right, knows. That one week the New England Journal of Medicine, or whatever it is, says we've just proven this, and the next week they say, oh, we made a little mistake on the addition or subtraction. I mean, in other words, we can make mistakes. That's the wild card. And here Moshe Rabbeinu, according to Rashi, made a mistake, and his mistake was that since he was already in Eretz Yisrael, and the Eretz Yisrael had been divided up between the tribes of Reuven, Gad, and Chatzi Shevet Menashe, so what difference would it make if he crossed the Jordan River and went into the rest of Eretz Yisrael? So that's Be'etahi. That's what Rashi says Be'etahi means, right? And Sheva Hutar HaNeda, he came to the conclusion, or he thought perhaps that God had released Moshe Rabbeinu from the oath that had been taken after the event of hitting the rock for water instead of talking to the rock.
Why would you have doubled it?
What?
If you really thought the oath was released, he says, I doubled my Pesahim at the time when I thought the oath would be released. And why would he be doubling at that time
if he
thought the
earth
had been released?
According to Rashi. Rashi doesn't answer that question. Rashi doesn't answer your question.
He raises the question.
But you could. No, he doesn't. He said, how could Moshe Rabbeinu daven for something that is impossible? Like, we all know that you can't do that. You can't daven for rain in the summer in Eretz Yisrael.
So he says daven, you know.
What?
So he explains why he thought it might have been possible.
Right, but there's a second step that Moshe Rabbeinu thought that even something that could happen, that might happen, that would happen, demanded prayer. It's like asking for rain in the winter. It was there something that's normal, but somehow we are integrated in the process, in that normal process. So Moshe Rabbeinu thought that that's what he should do. That's what he should do. He would get it. It was, according to Rashi, Moshe Rabbeinu would never daven for something that couldn't happen. So when it came to Bnei Yisrael, as Rav Nachman said in various, when it came to Bnei Yisrael, Moshe Rabbeinu was the ultimate defender of Bnei Yisrael, and therefore He was always going to be right. Whatever he davened for Bnei Yisrael, he was going to win because that's who he was. That was the job that God gave him. God gave him the job to defend Bnei Yisrael. And therefore, the obvious result of his defense is always going to be victory. Because that was the job. That's what God told him to do by them. When he came to Moshe Rabbeinu himself, that was not the case. He could not daven for the impossible. But he could daven for the possible. And it could be that that's how Moshe Rabbeinu evaluated the situation, that a person had to respond even to divine goodness. Right? If you respond by Shevach Vodoyo, or you respond by other kinds of tefillot, it was our obligation, or Moshe Rabbeinu's obligation as an individual, to respond to the idea that he could go into Eretz Yisrael. Or it could be that if Moshe Rabbeinu didn't notice what had happened and didn't indicate to the people what had happened, that he would again have failed as a leader of Bnei Yisrael, because he had an obligation to lead them into religious devotion. Right? They had to be frum about it. And frum about it meant recognizing that things had changed, even though he didn't understand why they had been changed. He hadn't done anything that it should be changed, but he understood that. That's Rashi. This is Rashi, all the this great Rashi, right? And then Rashi says about Lemor, you see the word Lemor. The word Lemor in the Chumash usually introduces a quote. Vayom Hashem al Moshe, Vayedaber Hashem al Moshe, Lemor. So Lemor is an unnecessary word. It just emphasizes the fact that what follows is a direct quote. Right, it's the words of God spoken by Moshe Rabbeinu to Bnei Yisrael. So here in the pasuk it says, "V'etchanan el Hashem be'itahi lemor." So what is lemor? What does the word lemor mean in this pasuk? Because what follows is what Moshe Rabbeinu said to God, not what God said to Moshe Rabbeinu. Not Moshe Rabbeinu quoting something; it's Moshe Rabbeinu speaking. This is what he said. So Rashi says, makes an interesting comment. This comment is I can't read what I wrote here, but it's in the Rashi in Bamidbar Yud Gimel 13 or Yud Bet 13. Rashi says about Lemor, look here at the word Lemor. זה אחד משלושה מקומות שאמר משה לפני המקום, איני מניחך עד שתודיעני אם תעשה שאלתי אם לא. So this is a different lemar, Rashi says. This doesn't mean, quote, this means a strong, powerful statement by Moshe Rabbeinu. Moshe Rabbeinu says that my tefillah, my personal prayer, must be responded to. God must answer whether I can go to Eretz Israel or not. And there are three places which the Rashi and Bamidbar notes. Okay? Pasuk Avdalet, Hashem Elokim, Atach Ilot Elorot Et Avdecha, Et God the Chavit Yedcha Chazaka, Hashem Mi'el Hashemayim Va'aretz Hashem Yasev Masek Vavot. You know that the names that are used for God are not obvious and not always easy to understand. As a general rule, as Rashi pointed out, Breshit bara Elokim et hashamayim v'et haaretz. Elokim midat hadin. Midat hadin means if you deserve to be punished, you're going to get whacked. There's no mercy. Right? There's only din. Yudkei Vavkei is Rachamim. Is Rachamim. So you know that in the creation itself, in the beginning of the second chapter of Bereshis, there is this change. Just one second. I love these little Tanachim, but I can't turn the pages. Phase. here. The Perek Bet Pasuk Dalet, it says, Eile Toldat HaShemayim Va'aretz Bihi Bar'am. These are the toldot, the generations, the histories of HaShemayim Va'aretz Bihi Bar'am, the creation of heavens and earth. Biyom, on the day, Asot HaShem Elokim Eretz V'Shamayim. So it's a change. In the beginning of Perek Aleph, it says, Breshit Bara Elokim Et HaShemayim Et HaAretz. In the beginning of Perek Bet, it says that the creation was done by Hashem.
But
Shema. Okay, but say there. I will katub b'hala katub b'yom asot Hashem Elokim Eretz v'Shamayim. The first pasuk it says Elokim, and in this pasuk it says Hashem Elokim. So it's hard not to notice that. So something changed. Something changed. In other words, the Medrash says that God created the world bedin, expecting that the created world would be able to live up to that standard. And it was realized in heaven that that could not be. And therefore the standard became Hashem Elokim. Hashem Elokim meaning Rachamim Bedin. That somehow mercy is kind of mixed in with the din. So everything changes. Everything changes, and this is the final change, of course, was after the Chet HaEgel, when Hashem said to Moshe Rabbeinu, Hashem, Hashem, Kel Rachum V'Chanun, Erchapai V'Chesed V'Emet, meaning that you could always be saved. Maybe not redeemed always, but you could always be saved. There'll always be Rachum. There's so much Rachum in the world. And this reminds us of the claim of the Arizal, which was adopted and repeated in Chassidut in every way imaginable. So Arizal asked the question, the beginning of a book called Eitz Chaim, that's like the big book that Rav Chaim Vital wrote. Chaim Vital was the Talmud of the Arizal, and he wrote the Torah of the Arizal. And the first section, the first question in the Eitz Chaim is, why did God create the world? Which means, the question means, what was God missing, so to speak, that forced the creation of the world? Right? You know, whatever question. So the answer was that the divine potential to have mercy could never be satisfied without a created world. It was, if you say Hashem is Rachum V'Chanun, who before the world was created, there was no way for Hashem to be Rachum V'Chanun. There was nothing to be Rachum V'Chanun about. You know, because it was only God, only what they called Ein Sof, which of course science has usurped and made into infinity. But Ein Sof was the way they referred to God. Right? The medieval Kabbalists referred to God as Ein Sof. And therefore, all there was God. There wasn't anything else. There wasn't anything else. And since there was only God, how would God be Rachum V'Chanun? And therefore, God created the world. Because, and so it had to be a world in which we could mess up. Now, how that happened, how God, who is perfect, could create a world in which everything could get messed up, is a second question that the Kabbalists tried to deal with. And they had different ways of doing it. I mentioned one before, that we were granted with the power of analysis, which also gave us the ability to be mistaken, right, and to be certain about our mistake. You know that the Yud Gimel Midot, Rabbi Ishmael, which are in the Sidur at the end of Brachot, at the beginning of the Sidur before Psukei Dezimra, which in a lot of shuls they actually do say that, because if people want to say Kaddish, they get in an extra Kaddish. You know, who knows what in the heavens they say. They're looking down and they're saying, well, what are you saying Kaddish for if you're Mechal Shabbos? You know, what's the big deal? I remember when I was a kid, I already was amazed at the devotion that people who are Mechal Shabbos had to say in Kaddish. It seemed like a contradiction in essence to me as a kid, but I was very accepting. So, anyway, Rabbi Yishmael lists the Yud Gimel Midot. That's the famous brayta of Rabbi Yishmael, which is supposed to be some kind of way that the Chachamim had of analyzing Psukim to produce new material, new Torah material. But only one of those Midot have innate, what we would call real innate logic. And that is the midah called Kal V'Chomer. If it's true for A, it should certainly be true for A plus. The Gemara says, interestingly enough, Ein Onshin Min Hadin. Gemara Sanhedrin and other places. Ein Onshin Min Hadin. You don't apply the punishment from the Kal V'Chomer. That means if A is guilty and his punishment is Y, then B is certainly guilty, but you can't punish him. He doesn't get the same punishment. He gets the guilt, but he doesn't get the punishment. Ein onshin min hadin. Why is that? Because the Chachamim realized, Rashi explains it in several places, the Chachamim realized that Kal V'Chomer is based on logic. And logic, or what we think is logical, often messes up. And therefore, you could establish guilt through a Kal V'Chomer, but you can't execute a punishment through a Kal V'Chomer because you might be mistaken. You might be mistaken. And all the other Midot, you're not going to be mistaken because they don't make any sense. You understand? So if they don't make any sense, where did you learn? I mean, I admit that what I'm saying now is not obvious from every line in the Rambam, but I'm saying it anyway. If it's not obvious that it's correct, then how do we know that it's correct? Huh? Tradition, nivuah, superiority of the Anshei Knesset HaGdolah. In other words, we have some other factor that makes it possible to say this is correct without a doubt. So if it's correct, without a doubt, that it's really part of the Torah. Even though it's not written in the Torah, and even though it's not really implied in the Torah, but we know that it must be correct because we could not have reached that conclusion without an extraordinary kind of piece of information. It must come from somewhere like that. So, that's very, very interesting. Well, how did I get to it? Which? I wanted to talk about Hashem Elokim, Atachi Lot Arot Avdecha. So you know that Hashem is usually written Yud Kei Vav Kei, and Elokim is usually written Aleph Lamed Hey Yud Mem. But in this case, in this pasuk, the opening statement that Moshe Rabbeinu makes in his own defense is Hashem Elokim, but written, right, Aleph Dalet Nun Yud. And then Yud Kei Vav Kei, right? So this is like a strange combination. Strange combination. Words that Rashi doesn't even notice, because Rashi says Hashem Elokim, Rashi, Rachum B'din, as I explained before, right, that there is merciful judgment. So it's just like it said Hashem Elokim at the beginning of Perek Bet, where it says Yud Kei Vav Kei, Elokim, Aleph Lamed A Yud Mem. So that's what Rashi says. Then, Rashi doesn't take note of the Hashem Elokim, the spelling of it, and the way the words are presented. Atach kilota larotet avdecha, et godecha ve'et yadcha chazaka, shomei v'shomayim v'arot v'shiyizek v'azek v'vuvatecha. You have shown your servant your power, your greatness, your strength. Rashi larotet avdecha, Patach liyot omeid umitpalev. Av al pi she nigzera gzera. Marlo, Mincha lemadati. So he says, Moshe Rabbeinu is arguing his case, even though Nigzera Gzera, even though Moshe Rabbeinu has this lumdus, according to Rashi, he said, I'm in Eretz Yisrael already. So why shouldn't I go further into Eretz Yisrael? So Rashi says, no, no. Patach liyot omeit umitpalev. Even though God has said that he's not going to go into Eretz Yisrael, Amarlo, Mimcha lamadati shamartali, you HaKadosh Baruch Hu have told me, Vata hanicha li, v'chi tofes hayiti b'cha, ela liftoach petach, shebi talui litpalev aleihem. This is Rashi's theory, that sometimes you have to daven. It's true that it's almost there. It's almost going to happen. Moshe Rabbeinu is almost going to be allowed to go to Eretz Yisrael, but you have to daven. You have to daven, and that he learned from HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Kimo kein hayiti sabur la'asot achshav, shebi talui litpalel aleihem. I have to daven for Bnei Yisrael. That's what God told me after the Chet HaEgel. So now here I think also that I have to daven for myself. And I have to daven myself. So you see that this davening business is kind of not obvious. It's not simple. Now, if you look at the Ramban, let's look at the Ramban. Hashem Elokim. You see Pasuk of Dalit? See Pasuk of Dalit? It's like, I would say, 40% of the way down in the Ramban. That's what I would say. Is that close? Hashem Elokim. Rachum Bedin Lashon Rashi. This is the Ramban. Now you know that the Ramban was a Kabbalist. Yes, even though he appears in the Mikraot Gedolot, he was a real Kabbalist. And he thought, the Ramban thought that in order to understand the Torah, you have to have this two-pronged approach. You have to understand the neglect, the revealed kind of explanation that everybody had to learn. And you also had to understand the nistar, the hidden understanding, which was limited to only to a few. But the Ramban, in his commentary on the Torah, which I think is a commentary that's aimed at regular people, I mean, you know, who are somewhat learned, nevertheless, the Ramban includes in his very long commentary on the Torah a lot of Kabbalistic material, which seems to me to mean that there was certain Kabbalistic material that he thought everybody should be privy to, that it was not problematic. I don't think he saw it as something that you just say without thinking about it, but that it was useful. The Ramban thought it was useful in understanding the basic intention of the Pasuk, just like the Negleh commentary was really there to help me understand what the Pasuk is saying. The same thing is true about the Nistar. Now look at this. We have to go through this here. Hashem Elokim, Rachum Bedin, Lashon Rashi, Velo Ishkiach Harav, Ki Hashem HaRishon Hu Katuv Ba'alef Dalet, V'Hasheni Hu Katuv Be'Yudkei. So you see my question? Not so clever of me, since the Ramban asked the question. In other words, the Ramban said that, you know, when it came to names of God and the use of the names of God in the Tanakh, the Kabbalah was the primary source, so to speak. The Kabbalah was very interested in this question. So the Ramban said, look, Rashi didn't relate at all to the way these words are spelled. And then he says, Vashenir Kadu B'Yudkei, Shebo amru kol makom shenemar Hashem zo midat rachamim Elokim zo midat adin Avol Hashemot haniskarot kan. It says it's true that Yudkei Vavkei is rachamim, Elokim is din, but that's when they're spelled in a normal way. Here they're spelled in an unreasonable way. If that was the simple intention of the Pasuk, okay, they would spell it as it's spelled at the end, at the beginning of the second chapter of Bereishit, Gadarachamim, right? Aval Hashemot haniskarim kan, Adon b'midat harachamim. What does it mean? Of the Master of Mercy. the master of mercy, not mercy in judgment, but the master of mercy. Ilam Deinu is a medrash, right? The medrash Ilam Deinu is another name for. It's a, like a quiz question. Quiz questions, they come up all your whole life. They never stop. Ilam Deinu is the Tanchuma. What's called the Tanchuma. And many paragraphs in the Medrash Tanchuma start with the words Ilam Deinu Rabbeinu. Rabbeinu is the Tanchuma. Rabbeinu Tanchuma. So in the literature, in the rabbinic literature, it's often called Medrash Ilam Deinu. Right? Bilam Deinu. Amarlo Ribono Lamim. Im mitbai li bedin have li v'ilo mitbai li bedin rachem alai, that if I deserve this by judgment, give it to me, and if not, then have mercy on me. Kishem Shema Abraham. This is Moshe Rabbeinu, like the master of mercy. So Moshe Rabbeinu says to God, if I'm supposed to go to Eretz Yisrael now, as Rashi said, right, because they conquered the land of Sichon Ba'og, let me go in. But if not, then have mercy on me, and let me in anyway. Kishem Shema Abraham, Hashem Elokim, Mati Teimli, V'gam Abraham Kach, Hem Ketuvim, Harishon Aleph Dalet, V'Shini Yud Hey. So up to now, he's explained that here, when Moshe Rabbeinu turns to God, according to the Ramban, Moshe Rabbeinu understands that he's in a kind of a quasi position. He doesn't know if he really deserves to go into Eretz Israel according to the situation, but he thinks that the situation demands him relating to the question, right? In other words, there's been a change. He just doesn't know what the implication of that change is. So he says to God, if I deserve it, so let me go in. And if I don't deserve it, have mercy on me, that I will be able. That's why the names of God are used as the opening to this prayer. Okay? V'inyana parasha yuvad baze. And I'm going to tell you about what's going on here. Rashi's question, here the Ramban asks Rashi's question, but openly. He says, why is this word used and not the regular word vet palel, the regular word? Ki yidaber betechina v'amar. If Moshe Rabbeinu is talking about a techina, like that's what he's saying. Why? What's a techina? V'amar adon, asher b'cha rachamim. In other words, Moshe Rabbeinu was looking to God and saying, I realize the greatness of God, and the greatness of God even overwhelms the nether, even overwhelms what was the position, the previous position. I see, I understand who God is and how great and how strong. And from this you will see why God got angry at Moshe Rabbeinu. He got angry at Moshe Rabbeinu because he assumed that something had changed, that God had owed him something, so to speak. Aval Hashem Sifri, the Medrash says, Kol Makom Shema Hashem, Zo Midas Rachamim Shenemar Hashem, Kel Rachum V'Chanun, Hashem Hashem, Kel Rachum V'Chanun, Elokim Zo Midas Adin Shneimar Ad Elohim Yuvad Shneihem. Here the word Elohim means Dayanim. Vakavana Lefaresh Ki Hashem Hasheni Bekan Hu Midat Harachamim Hu Hashem Amiuchad Ushar Hashemot Kulan Midat Adin Kmo Elohim Shu Hashem Dam Dayanim. Because she came Aleph Dalet Shulishon Adonim. So in other words, the way the Ramban works it out is that Moshe Rabbeinu understood something. And there's something that he understood indicated to him that he should make the request, that he should stand before God. But in fact, God got angry because Moshe Rabbeinu should have understood that in spite of his reasoning, the nether would remain, that there would be no change, and that going to Eretz Israel meant crossing the Jordan River onto the west side and had nothing to do with what happened with Sichon and Og. And then the Ramban says, V'hinei hishlim ha-tochechot bazeh shehodat shehodia otam shegarmu avotechem ra'a al atzmam v'gam alav garmu one shelo ya'avru ba'aretz avolheim abanim ya'avru v'yishu ota im lo yukav otam dor tzoveh u'moveh. In other words, that's the point. The point here is that we ask for superior knowledge from the Avot and Moshe Rabbeinu, even though the children who are going to go into Eretz Israel don't have that superior knowledge. Which brings us to an interesting question, I think, which is discussed here in the, turn the page in Shemishmur. What? The Shemishmuel is Sochachov. Rav Shmuel, he's the son of the Sochachov, who wrote several very important Sfarim. And in Yeshivot, he's referred to by the names of his Litvisha type Sfarim, like the Egle Tal and the Shilas and Shuvas of the Egle Tal or Shilas and Shuvas of the Sochachov. So that, in Yeshivot, they managed to separate. It's like the Rambam. The Rambam in the Yeshivot is the Yad HaChazakah. It's very rare that anybody in the Yeshiva would mention the Mora Nebuchim. Just as many people in the university think that the Rambam wrote the Mora Nebuchim, and they don't know that he also wrote it. This kind of dichotomy is quite remarkable, I think. So the same thing is true with the Sochachov. The Sochachov was a real Rebbe. Like, you don't have that in Yeshivot. But the Sfarim that he wrote are very highly regarded in Yeshivot. And in the Mishneh Berurah, right close to Sochachov. so that this distinction between the Hasidut and the Halakha exists for the Sochachov as well. Now, Shmuel was his son. The Sochachov apparently was not a great writer, didn't write easily, and his son wrote up a lot of the stuff that he said, you know, Shabbatot, and he was his, is it Boswell? Is he Boswell? Which one wrote?
Boswell.
So he's Boswell, the son, Shmuel. So listen to this. Listen to what he says. Irashim. אף על פי שיש להם הצדיקים לתלות במעשיהם הטובים, אין מבקשים מעט המקום, אלא מתנת חינם. You remember, Rashi, that Chanan, Chet Nun Nun, is somehow parallel to Chet Nun Mem, which means Chinam, free, for nothing. That tzadikim don't go and ask God for compensation. I did mitzvot, do me a favor, and do something good for somebody. That's Rashi, right? This is Rashi. Ad kad mishol note, the second line. Yesh lahavin. The Sefer Shmuel says, I don't understand. Alo yodua. Shekol ma she'adam tzadik biyoter. Biyodea et gadlut Hashem yitbarach. Hu yodea biyoter. She'adayin lo asa me'uma. So this is like a Hasidic idea. He says, everybody understands that the greater you are, the more you understand that the way you did it is not good enough. In other words, there's elasticity in doing mitzvot, in listening to God, and achieving some sort of spiritual level. It's elastic. So everybody's a shul together. All the people are shul together. They're all doing the same mitzvah. You know, they're shaking a lulav. Like, that's always a pretty kind of simple, straightforward kind of mitzvah, it's hard to mess up. Shaking the lulav. But you know, the Shemesh rule says some people shake the lulav and they're in heaven. And some people shake the lulav and they're on their way home. So there's a difference between in the ways that you can perform a mitzvah. They're not, according to the Shemesh rule, they're not pro forma. They're not something you just do. So he says, somebody who's righteous knows that God is great and that his commands are profound. That he hasn't really done anything yet. He shaked the lulav, but he didn't really do it. Lomat yuvo neged gadlut Hashem yitbarach. God is so great that how could I even imagine that I've done it? So like Shem Yishmael said, what's Rashi talking about? What's he talking about? These tzaddikim who are not going to ask God for anything. Of course they're going to ask God for anything because they don't think they did it. Not because it's a measure of their tzidkut. Not because tzaddikim are like sort of quiet and naive and they say, well, I didn't really do anything. No, because he really didn't do anything. It's really real what he says. Right, because he was not able to penetrate the profundity of the mitzvah act. He's just imitating. I mean, how could it be that the same thing is done by a 5-year-old child and a 70-year-old man, woman, right? How could it be? It can't be the same. But if it is the same, then you know that you didn't do much. So he says, Shevet Shmuel. This is a well-known story. Rav Sadia Gaon. Remember, he was a Gaon, Bavel, had a tremendous impact in his own lifetime and philosophy and halakha, and still today he translated the Chumash into Arabic, and the Yemenites to this day, when they read the Torah, they read the Targum in between after each pasuk, which makes Kriyat HaTorah very long. But that Targum that they read is the Targum of Rav Sadia Gaon. It's not Unkelus. So what did Rav Sadia Gaon say? Shasat tshuva bekol yom al kotzer avodah de'etmo. What do you think about that? Every day, Rav Sadia Gaon did tshuva on the mess that he made yesterday. Right? You know, he had to say brachot, he had to put on tefillin, he made a mess of it. He knew that he was not successful in achieving the level of mitzvah action that he should have been. So Asa Tshuva b'kol yom ha-kotzer avodat etmol v'asher yisig b'kol yom chadashot b'gadlut Hashem yitbarach. After all, he was learning Torah, he understood more and more and more. So what he understood today, he had understood yesterday, what he didn't understand yesterday. Rav Nachman said something similar about tshuva. He says, he says it backwards, like Rav Sadia Gaon says it this way, Rav Nachman says it the other way. He says, well, when you do tshuva, you come close to God, you come closer to God. And the first thing you realize when you come close to God is that you didn't do enough tshuva. So that tshuva is like that puzzle with the hare and the tortoise and the hare. Like you never win. You never get enough tshuva to cover all the averis, because tshuva itself is expandable. And tshuva creates a new person. I mean, it gives you new insights. And when you have those new insights, you say, gee, you know, I didn't do enough tshuva. So there's a question in halacha appears in the Shai Tshuva also. Do I have to do tshuva on something I did tshuva for last year? That is a question. I mean, it's not a question of a depressed Protestant. It's a question of a spiritually inclined person. If tshuva can only be done by the spirit within me, that if I feel I've gained spirit, I've somehow developed, maybe I should do tshuva again, right? It's an interesting question. You see, b'chol yom chadashot b'gadlut Hashem yitbarach, v'bedrash, mikaret alameit she'ein, lebir yeklum eitzel bar'o, that there is no connection between the created and the creator in Cain. So he says, what's Rashi talking about? Of course the tzaddikim are not going to go to God and say, I have money in the bank. Because they know that the money in the bank is being depleted. Right? It's losing its value every second. So they're not going to do it. This question is Shevi Shmuel. So I can translate it the language of davening. You say, well, I mean, how can you daven? How can you ask for anything? What is the basis on which you ask? So he says, even tzaddikim don't have a basis to ask for anything when they're davening, right? They, the tzaddikim, understand that they have not achieved the thing. Mikotsk, the Kotzker Rebbe, was his father's father-in-law. Does that make sense? Bezivuk Sheni, right? His father, the Sochachover, married the daughter of the Kotzker after his first wife died. So he says, this is my grandfather, right? The Kotzker was my grandfather, he was. Higitsha Perush. So that's the Kotzker. He said that what Rashi was talking about was not the credit that you have from the past, but the credit that you hope to have in the future. That the tzaddikim would come to God and say, look, I hope to do better. And based on that, I'd like to ask you for a little mercy. Right? So that's the Kotzker's vort. That the future also counts. That, and he says, he, the Sochachava, the Shem Shmuel, says, Eino Muvan, Shemikra Malehu. He says, it's not like that. He says, a pasuk in Mishle, Al Titalel Biyom Machar, Kilo Teda Mayal Edyo. I mean, you can't say much about that. Al Titalel, don't be so proud of Yom Machar, of what you're going to do tomorrow. Because, lo teda, you don't really know what's going to happen. So there's a machlokes between the Shem Shmuel and the Kotzker. The Kotzker says, you can draw on the account of the future. That somehow the present indicates the future. Even though you know that in the present you haven't done it yet, but you're on the road. You're on the road. If you're on the road, you should be able to demand that the future will also be in the cheshbon. I walked up to Shem Shmuel. He says, "Look, there's a pasuk in the there's a pasuk in Mishlei which seems to say exactly the opposite." So you see that the Chachamim were having that we're all having trouble with Moshe Rabbeinu. What is he doing? What is his davening? What is all this? I just wanted to mention to you something that I came across recently. For other reasons, there is this series of this is like a fascicle. Can you call this a fascicle? A choveret. It's this guy Schreiber. His name is B. David Schreiber. He went through Rabbi Soloveitchik's oral Sheurim and collected it and then just copied it out and printed it. And it's called Sefer Noraot HaRav. The awesome words of Rabbi Soloveitchik, but it's not really ordered in any way. It's like what the Shia that the Rav gave. They didn't take the parts about this topic and put them here and that topic, but they just like wrote it out. And this, as you can see, well, you can't see, but if you could see, I have a couple of these of them. This was printed in February 1999. And here on the spine, it says 10. Is I have 9 and 10, 8, 9 and 10. So he put out at least 10 in 1999. But now, of course, it's on the internet. So you don't have to buy any of them. And I just have them as museum pieces. But it's on the internet. You can access all of this. You can access the one 1999, which is about Purim, Esther, and Torah Shabbat Peh. That's what he says here. But here, let's see what Rabbi Soloveitchik says. He was talking to Korach. He was talking about Korach. He says there's another reason for according priority to the act over the experience. He's talking about davening, really. The act, you daven. And we all know there's a mitzvah of davening. And we all know that this is the kind of thing that people are annoyed by. Like, how can I daven? I mean, I don't feel like davening. I'll daven when I feel like davening. I can't daven. I don't feel like davening. You know, all that kind of... So the Rav is here expressing the literature position, which is that the only thing you could know about God is what God told us to do. Again, there's nothing else you could know. There's nothing else. No, God is wholly other, right? Rudolf Otto. He's out there someplace. There's no way to connect. There's no way to connect. All that we can do is to do the mitzvah. So if you see that even in the last 100 years, the way the ideology of the yeshivot has developed, you know, the guys in yeshiva, it has always to do with details. They always get you on a detail. Right? Everybody's had children in yeshivot, and they come home, you know that the first thing they say is, you gotta do it this way, and not that way. And that's a philosophical position, according to Rabbi Soloveitchik, because the only thing, it's the literature position, the only thing you can know about God is what God said He wants of us. That's all. And therefore, if you want to know more about God, you have to learn more about a lulav. Right? Learning more about a lulav is somehow parallel to learning more about God, as strange as that may seem. It's a very welcoming kind of ideology, because trying to understand about God is a little bit too difficult for 99% of the people in the world. That is certainly not something that you could run the organization called Jewish People on. But if you say that you need an esrog, oh, that everybody can get into. Everybody can get into it on whatever level you are at. Everybody can get into buying an esrog, having an esrog, looking at their esrog, thinking about their esrog, whatever. So the Rav said, there's another reason for according priority to the act. This is page, I'm reading on page 92. To the act over the experience, it is simply impossible to determine what is what and who is whom. We can never determine what is a religious experience in contradistinction to a hedonic, mundane experience. I could read this with passion. You want me to do that? Mm-hmm. The Rav was great at that. I mean, he just was unbelievable. There's some tapes of shiurim that they used to sell in bookstores. You know, Korach and Chukas. They're just tremendous. We know of many hedonic emotions which are provided with enormous power, which are hypnotic and at first glance redemptive. One may easily confuse the religious drive with the love impulse. It is quite normal to replace the religious aesthetic craving with aesthetic yearning of the artist. There are common characteristics in both of them. The quest for exaltedness and infinity is typical of both the experience of beauty and of religion. To substitute secular for religious emotion is again an idolatrous method. The pagans of old would indulge in hypnotic or orgiastic ceremonials, mistakenly identifying them with the religious experience. The Torah provided idolatry practices to be introduced in the ritual service of God. And then he says, the rousing of religious awareness by confronting it with the powerful hypnosis of the aesthetic experience, such as music, art, architecture, is alien to Halakha Judaism. Yes, he said that. Rabbi Soloveitchik, you know that very modern Orthodox rabbi, he said that. It's all shtuyot. And what he means, and even though he didn't think so, in a universal kind of way, you know, he could have been seen a lot of people, including himself, as exceptions to these general rules. But in general, what he said is that prayer is an obligation. We call that a mitzvah. At least most of us accept the definition of the Rambam, which is that davening twice a day, at least twice a day, is a mitzvah min haTorah modified by the Chachamim. The mitzvah in the Torah is that you should daven once a day. The Chachamim said you should daven twice a day. But they didn't say why you're davening. But why are we davening? So the Rav would say, it's not that we are interested so much in having a religious experience called tefillah, which is what Chassidut said. Chassidut said you could do that, you could have a religious experience called tefillah, but we are davening because there's a mitzvah to daven. And therefore what I think about davening in the morning, when I say think about davening in the morning, I think about what time is it, and where am I up to, and am I going too fast, am I going too slow, am I standing where I'm supposed to be sitting, am I sitting where I'm supposed to be standing. That's what I think, because that's the way into davening. But if I try to absorb, to create an experience which is not halakhically viable, like, like a Karl Bach minyan. Right? Like, what are you doing with a Karl Bach? What do you do with a Karl Bach minyan? Why do people go to Karl Bach minyan? Because they like it, I imagine. And what don't they like? They don't like going to shul. So they go to Karl Bach minyan. So, according to this, this is page 92 and 93, according to this, you can't do that. You can't do that because the Shulchan Aruch does not mention Karl Bach Minyanim. It's not in there, any place. In the shul that I daven in, there's an ongoing, week after week after week, disagreement about whether they should sing L'chadodi or not. And if they do sing L'chadodi, it has to be in the one melody that makes you unhappy. But the thought of singing L'chadodi with a melody that is joyous is absolutely anathema to some of the people who are davening in the shul. And I understand that it comes from this fear, because of this fear of involving emotion in a way that is unreasonable. And here the Rav goes pretty far to say that, after all, emotional responses were very common to idolatrous practice. The people who practiced idolatry, you know, got themselves all revved up for whatever was going to happen by with music, with dancing, with all kinds of, you know, smoke and things like that. So that this problem of Moshe Rabbeinu, the problem of what was Moshe Rabbeinu doing, why was he davening at all, is something that might concern us today. You know, I mean, everybody has a position. Everybody has a position of davening, and you know that the Hasidim and the Misnagdim are profoundly in disagreement about what davening is all about. What davening is all about. You know, there's the story about the Netziv. The Netziv was the Rosh Yeshiva of the Lodge. And the Elul, you know, all the new students came, and Elul, so they were davening chakras. And the Netziv finished davening after whatever number of minutes he davened in Shemon Esrei. And there was still a new student who was davening Shemon Esrei, and kept davening. And he was like a Zinsha guy who came to the yeshiva because he was probably a talented student. So after Shabbos, the Tzid goes over and says, in this yeshiva, I say the longest Shemon Esrei. It means like, you can't let run away with you, right? You got to think about the obligations and what it is that you're supposed to be doing. So, okay.